What's going on, guys? Welcome to the show. Welcome to another episode of Action Movie Anatomy here on the Popcorn Talk Network, chatting with what I believe is one of the more underrated movies of all time today, Road to Perdition. We are going to break the whole thing down for you guys. We'll see you in just one quick second.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Action Movie Anatomy.
We came in on the beat this time.
Yes, we did. I don't know if you guys recognize this song. It's from a little album like to call The Chronic.
2001. It was released in the year 2000.
And it also plays every time that we enter the entrance, the arena of the
Movie Trivia Schmodown, and every time that we start this show.
When we go to win matches, this is the song you hear.
Yeah. We destroyed Deep Cuts. The janitors, Tab and Eric, they tried really hard, and it was great for them. But in all sincerity, Fad and Aaron, I think it's the first time I've ever called them by their real name. They're awesome guys. We're super excited to be here, and we got another match coming up, right?
We have another match coming up. In the pre-show here, Andrew was writing something on his piece of paper here and trying to show it to me for me to, like, you know, not ask. And it looks like he just wrote steak with any underlined it.
I did.
And then I looked at him puzzled, and he really made the T in steak notable and underlined it, and it still looks like steak.
It just says steak. I haven't even told him why.
I don't know what he's getting at. So welcome to the show, guys. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy. We're here to break down movies, break down action movies. We talk action movies here on the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network dedicated to talking pop culture by the bucketful. So, guys, it's Road to Perdition today. This is a movie that you may hear and say, that is not an action movie. And the reason is this. We did 100 episodes of this show.
We did.
With the premise that we were going to do mostly movies that were driven by action. And we found over that 100 episodes that a lot of the movies we loved, we actually loved the spots between the action more than the action itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was more about this feeling that that the movie creates for you. You know what I mean? Like, yep. It's about the feeling that you get while watching the movie. It's not really about the action scenes. You know, we'll go through and watch a lot of movies. The Town is a great example of a movie that it's like, we say it feels like it should be on our show.
Yep,
even
totally.
Though it doesn't necessarily follow the rules
which is
of our show.
Funny, because in the beginning, guys, for a lot of you that have listened or watched since the very beginning know that the old days were a lot of movies like Under Siege and Point Break and Predator and classics, even going into the more like modern era of movie making like John Wick, where they very much just like fit that profile. If you looked at a list online of the greatest action movies, that's what we thought we were going to do the show about.
We did do that show.
A lot of it. And what we found over time, though, was that Andrew and I loved movies that were driven by moments and drama as much as the action. So we sort of expanded to movies that have enough action in them to make them feel like our show.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the coolest thing about this movie is that although there is little action in it, the action is also very effective.
Yeah. Super effective. So, Road to Perdition, guys. One of the movies another movie I saw in theaters with my dad.
Super weird, man. This one's not as crazy because it's still intense.
'02. Yeah, this was like a super cool one for us to go see. I remember these years. And we're excited to talk about this. So, guys, here we are. It's Action Movie Anatomy. If you want to follow along with the conversation, there's a couple ways to do it. You can find me personally on Twitter at Ben Bateman Media.
You can find me at Andrew Guy on Instagram and Twitter. And you can find our Facebook fan page on it. It's called Action Movie Anatomy Fan Page. I don't know what's wrong with me today. I think I'm very excited.
Struggling, yeah.
I really am. It's called the Action Movie Anatomy Fan Page. You guys can find it on Facebook. And it's been growing rapidly, exponentially. I think we've gotten 200 people in the last, 4 weeks is what I sent you.
And this was started just by a couple of our fans on the show, Richard and Eddie and Jay Clymer.
Yeah.
And honestly, guys, you did such a great job starting this thing that we should have started clearly 2 years ago, because it's like the most interactive thing we've ever created. Like, it took us like 2 years to get 500 Twitter followers. We have like as many people in this group in like 4 weeks.
Yeah, and they're always interacting. And you can also find our podcast at AMA Podcast on Twitter.
Absolutely, guys. That's the best way to catch up with the conversation. So a lot going on. We're going to get straight into it. But before we do, we should remind you guys that we cover action movies on this show, and those action movies adhere to four basic rules. Rule number one, the hero always plays by their own rules.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, Michael Sullivan's the smartest guy in the room, which is rule number two, the hero and the villain are always the smartest people, things, beings, what have you, in the room.
And it's interesting because although Paul Newman and Daniel Craig are the, I guess, more villain. They're like the true villains. Jude Law is the more traditional action movie villain in this.
Totally. And he's the smartest guy in the room in the sense that he's very capable.
Absolutely. I mean, you see what happens at the end of the film, and he also was written into this script. He was not in the original book, so he was very necessary.
Rule number three, the movie is driven by police, military, political, or mercenary figure. When we say political, it means they could be the man or work for the man, i.e. they could be an MTA officer in The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
Ben's favorite movie of all time.
I can't get a gallon. I can get a half gallon.
Why?
You bring me milk. You go straight at the hurdles. You go straight at the hurdles.
You tell it yourself. Sorry, I didn't mean to catch up.
Just had a stroke. And rule number four, the movie contains a minimum of one explosion. So I think, you know, rule number three, he's a mercenary in the sense that he works for the mob. And contains a minimum of one explosion.
Is there an explosion? I feel like there's an explosion.
Oh, maybe there's not, actually.
There's an explosion of a glass jar to Jude Law's face.
Yeah, right? I don't think there's an explosion in this movie. Nothing gets lit on fire.
Yeah, I was trying to think about it. There's always like some sort of like explosion with alcohol and like movies that take place in the Prohibition. I don't know, guys. Let us know if there is a explosion in this movie. I can't really think of it.
Yeah, so those are the four rules of action movie anatomy, guys. We usually try to hit at least three of them these days.
Yes,
but,
we do.
But coming up on today's show, we have a bunch of things to talk about. We are going to be talking about ageless movie stars. Who are the definitive ageless movie stars of all time that have had the widest, most incredible careers? We're going to be ranking Sam Mendes' films. I think he has like 8 or 9 films now, so we're going to talk about a collaborative ranking there. We're going to answer some awesome AMA questions and, of course, do all of the other games you guys are used to hearing. These a statement, favorite line, fist pump moment. Let's get straight into the show, guys, and let's watch the trailer before we get to fist pump moment.
Did I say prohibition or probation?
I don't know. It wasn't. I'm not really sure. I said prohibition.
Peter, I can't come to your concert remember the trailer. Tonight. I'm working.
Working at what? What's Papa's job?
This is the song,
English
right?
Mr. Rooney.
That's the one they play.
Who's got a hug for a lonely old man?
Papa didn't have a father, so Mr. Rooney looked after him.
You rule this town as God rules the earth.
I love Mr. Rooney. We had nothing. He gave us a home. A life.
Oh. That's a pretty great trailer.
Here's our missions for Mr. Rooney.
Yeah. Take Mike with you.
Enough, Pawn.
Take Mike with you.
Daniel Craig's such a fuck in this movie.
That's why he brings
his
gun.
He's great. He is really good.
Even the very first scene.
What the hell are you busy. Thinking?
So his accent is not as clean all the way through as
for sure.
Can you keep us
Newman's. Newman's is fantastic.
He's my son.
A man of honor always keeps his word.
Michael, tomorrow when they find out we're gone, they're gonna come after us. I have to protect you now.
It's a good trailer.
Yeah, it's
I'd
really
like
good.
To apologize, especially to you, Pawn.
You would like to apologize? Sons are put on this earth to trouble their fathers.
Yeah.
Natural law.
You gotta take him now.
I know who to call.
There's a guy who's done some work for us in the past.
The trailer should have ended right now.
Yeah,
do what you love.
It's too long.
Well, it's interesting because I recently watched the Goodfellas trailer.
Yeah.
And it's 3 minutes long.
Huh.
How long is this one? It's like 240?
This is less than 240, or less than 2 so far, but...
How long is it, Steve?
It won't make it.
Yeah, that's way too much.
No, yeah, this needed to be like a minute 25.
Well, I mean, even if you're going to do a minute 54, this is way too much of the story, for sure.
What are you going to do?
Just one last thing, and then it's done.
Yeah. Hanks in his fucking prime.
Yeah, I mean, his prime, he had so many primes.
He did. Yeah, he had a solid, like, 15-year prime.
Yeah. Jude Law's in a very interesting...
He's great in this.
Oh, I actually really like Jude Law in general.
Yeah.
None of us will see heaven.
Come on.
They give way too much away.
Yeah. So not a fan of the trailer, even though it starts off... Fantastic.
The first minute of that trailer. I feel like you could have done a 1 minute teaser for that and it would have been
totally. And it was interesting because I wanted to talk about the trailer because I didn't remember watching it and I don't remember this movie like coming out.
Really?
Yeah, not really. I
don't remember seeing that trailer. I never remember watching it.
I think it was marketed well because I'm sure the other trailers were much more of a tease than that.
Yeah.
So this is perfect because I want to get into our next segment because I really have a lot to say about my with my thesis today.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Excellent. Guys, the thesis statement is the part of the show where if you've watched or listened before, you know, we share a big, bold thought, something that's almost rooted in hyperbole, the greatest this, the only this, the first time something's happened. And you really want to back it up with your points all throughout the episode. And, you know, it's not supposed to be, this is my favorite thing this actor's ever been in, or, you know, this shootout was one of the coolest ones I've seen in my lifetime. Like, it really should be a little bit more definite than that. You want to be able to back this up. If somebody asks you about the movie at a party, this is where you go. Yeah. So, Mr. Andrew Guy, what do you got?
So, I had a few that I went back and forth between, but the one that I really stuck with is that this movie is the legacy of this film is the biggest anomaly that we've ever had on this show. It makes no sense to me why this movie is so forgotten, why no one talks about it,
yeah.
Why it's not considered one of Hanks's and Newman's best performances. It's by Sam Mendes the year after, I mean, not the year, the movie after American Beauty came out, which is only 3 years later.
Yep.
Like, it doesn't make any sense.
I'll jump in with mine because it's very much in the same world, which is my thesis statement for this film is that this is the most underrated film of Tom Hanks's career. And it's, you know, when we had this conversation last night where we were obviously attacking the same idea from different sides.
Yeah.
And I looked through his films, and it wasn't even a question of quality of the other films. It was a question of the quality of this film. And everything you just said, to add to those things, you can really go down the list. You mentioned this is the next film, the follow-up to American Beauty, one of the most beloved Best Picture winners, really, of its era.
Right.
This is Paul Newman's last on-screen speaking performance, for which he got nominated for Best Supporting Actor. And he lost that year to Chris Cooper for adaptation, who is
which
great.
Is very good. He's very good in that. But it's, I don't know. I feel like Chris Cooper is more of a caricature, whereas Newman is like a believable character.
And Newman's just so good in this movie.
Yeah, you text me. I was just pulling this up. You text me last night at 1 a.m. being like, Perdition is a low-key masterpiece. What's not good about it?
Right. And I mean, if you think about, there's so many things that should make this movie more loved and more popular, right? So Hanks, it's the tail end of his real prime, like the you know, 90, 91, 92, 93 to like 03, 04 kind of era. That's like when Tom Hanks was doing like the meat of his stuff. And this is a couple years after Castaway. Castaway is 2000. This is 2002. Like, he was making, this is the same year as Catch Me If You Can. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
I think the two most underrated movies of his whole career came out the same year.
That's actually 100% true, because he's excellent in Catch Me If You Can.
So good.
Yeah, man. I mean, and it really, it's just, it makes no damn sense.
None.
At all. And the other things to add to it, I'm sorry, what's his name again? Cody Hall? No, not Cody Hall. That's the guy in the Schmodown.
Conrad L.
Conrad
L. Hall.
L. Hall. He, we got two people in here talking about how it's the greatest cinematography in a film.
Ever.
Maybe ever.
It's so incredible. Conrad L. Hall, you told me this great story about Conrad L. You can just tell it now, actually.
Yeah, it was just, it's in the trivia on IMDb, and it's this really cool moment. And Conrad Hall was setting up a shot of Newman.
Yep.
And this is obviously while he was still alive. I thought it was after he died because of the way that it's worded. But then I had to have a conversation with you about it.
Yeah.
And so he's setting up the shot for Newman, and he pulls away from the lens and he's crying.
Yeah.
And someone asks him, what's up, man?
You know,
what's going on? And all he says is, he was so beautiful. He was so beautiful.
Yeah.
And it gives me chills even talking about it, because it speaks volumes about where Hall is in his life and his career, watching him grow up. He grew up watching Newman, you're saying. Like, he grew up wanting to be a cinematographer, or like becoming a cinematographer, mastering his skill while watching Newman, one of the greatest actors of all time.
So they were both in their late 70s when they filmed this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think Conrad L. Hall was like maybe 76 when he made it, and I think Newman was 77.
Yeah.
And there's a relationship between Conrad L. Hall and Paul Newman, because this is the last film either of them ever did. And on screen for Newman, he was in Cars. But going back to the beginning of Newman's career and some of the movies that made him so famous, Conrad L. Hall was also the cinematographer on Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yep.
He was the cinematographer, I believe, on perhaps The Sting and at least one other very famous Paul Newman movie. He worked with Newman in Cool Hand Luke. That's the movie.
Yeah. So he literally watched him age through the lens.
Yeah. And I think it really speaks volumes to the presence of Paul Newman, and also how tragic it must be to have worked alongside someone for so long. And Newman's the best part of this movie. I think we can both agree.
Yeah, and it's and again, it's the same thing that you said before about not speaking to Hanks's other films being poor.
Yeah,
because the other performances in this movie are fantastic. Every other leading man, including Michael,
yeah,
are excellent.
Everybody, yeah. But nonetheless, it's like there's a real lifespan you can see in Newman's eyes, and there's a sadness to him in all the scenes that he's deliberating over what he's supposed to do with his son, with his actual son, Connor Rooney, and. But even in the beginning of the film, when he isn't so in such a tragic character, he just looks so defeated and old. And
yeah,
he has so much character on his face, but the bottom line is he's almost 80. So I can understand that story and what it means. And it's just, yeah. Anyway, but all the things we were mentioning in our thesis statements about this being such an underrated film, you can even continue to go down the list. And it's things like hiring Paul Newman and Tom Hanks, two Oscar winners to lead the film.
And Jude Law is this like hot, up-and-coming, sexy dude.
Oscar nominated. Yep. Jennifer Jason Leigh, Oscar nominated. Yep. Stanley Tucci, I believe, Oscar nominated. Sam Mendes, the follow-up to him winning Best Picture at the time, the second youngest director ever to win Best Director. You continue going down the list. It's like Conrad L. Hall, one of the most legendary cinematographers. The music in this film.
Oh, yeah. That was another thing that I'd missed in here is people were saying that this is one of the greatest original soundtracks ever.
The song Road to Perdition, the actual main track, it plays in the scene where... plays three different times in the movie. It plays especially in the scene where Hanks is recovering from the gunshot.
Yeah.
I listen to... like, I have a Spotify playlist called Beautiful Scores with about 120 specific songs, and I usually listen to it in the background while I do work just because it doesn't distract me.
I have a similar playlist.
Yeah. This is one of the marquee songs. I've probably heard the song 1,000 times. It's
beautiful. We wanted to open the show to it, but it's a little low energy to start our show off. So yeah, guys, if you guys have any other thesis statements, let us know in the chat. And thanks to everyone that is in the live chat. We're really happy to have you there. I see a couple new names. There's a lot of great discussion going on. Anytime we talk about anything on the show, chat along with us, and I'm very happy to bring it up as long as I see it. All right, let's move on, brother.
Totally. I even just last thought on it. Even the subject matter, crime films, they're so palatable. Like, people love crime movies. How did this movie not catch hold more?
You know, I'm actually going to just mention this because we got a new guy in here, Barry O'Mack. Yeah, Jesus, it's a beautiful, long name. I'm just going to say Barry O'Mack. And he says it's a genre that passes by the mainstream, and he references Live by Night as another movie that was good but mainly forgotten.
Yeah.
I liked Live by Night fine. But it's odd because we're also obsessed with crime drama.
Yeah,
like Goodfellas, you know, like movies. There's so many great crime dramas that we just love.
I think today, it's a genre that has become a caricature of itself. It became so oversaturated with films like with the show
Public
like
Enemies.
The Sopranos running and all. Yeah, I think people were trying to make these movies, and I think the public got over it a little bit. But O2 is still early on enough. It's 15 years ago at this point, where I don't think we were there yet. Like, Live by Night to me feels like I'm watching a movie where I feel like I've seen this before.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when you watch The Rise and Fall of a Drug Kingpin type of movie now. It's like, I've seen that story too many times to get, like, super invested anymore.
I just recently called you to talk to you that I'd watched The Drop.
Yeah.
And, again, great actors.
Yeah.
Great movie. But it's just all too similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just too easy. It's
just
on the
too
nose.
Easy. Everything. Like, I told you, and I'm not a person that likes to be like, oh, I know what's going to happen in this. I can guess the plot of this movie. I like to be surprised by movies. I like to enjoy them. I like to be kind of naive while watching. I don't like to let things go past me, but at the same time, you know, so it was just one of those things where it was a good movie, but it was very by the numbers, whereas this movie hits in every way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So moving into the next part of the show, guys, what we have coming up next is called Fist Pump Moment. If you've watched or listened to the show before, you know Fist Pump Moment's that thing that happens in the movie where you look around and you're like, are you seeing this right now? This is unbelievable. I get to watch the rest of this movie. This is crazy.
Yeah, you want to like stop it and rewind it. You want to make sure the person that was sitting next to you watching saw it.
Yeah. So for me, this is a hard one because you and I think we have the same favorite line probably, and it really is one of the situations where it doubles as my fist pump.
So I knew you were going to say that. But I actually do have a real fist pump.
Me too. Yeah. I changed mine because I want to save
it. Better not be the damn same one. What is
it? Probably
yours?
Is.
What is it?
It's the scene in the rain.
Oh no, it's not.
Good. For me, my fist pump moment is it's that incredible Conrad L. Hall cinematography. It's just so perfect. Where Hanks has the interaction with Newman, and he basically gives him the ultimatum, and Newman leaves the scene by saying, you know, if you leave, I'll mourn the loss of my son.
Yeah, which is. God, that's such a great line.
So, heartbreaking, incredible scene.
Because you don't know who he's talking about.
Yeah.
He's either talking about Craig or he's talking about Hanks.
And, you know, Hanks goes and he gets the gun and he says, just one more thing. And I love the way that scene happens, that it's all silent, and they come out, and Newman's knocking on the window, and he sees the guy in the car, and he's been killed.
And he just, yeah.
He comes back for a second, and he realizes, and the sound, it's just the sound of the water,
yeah.
I believe, or it's just music. And then you start to see the gun, the lights in the distance go off.
Flashing.
And it's just amazing as each of these guys, one at a time, falls. But, of course, Newman doesn't. And I love that they choose to do that. That it's not like Newman takes a stray bullet, but he's still standing up.
Yeah, you don't want it. You don't want that. It's because Hanks is also he's a master of what he does. He's a master of his craft, and you see it exactly when Daniel Craig at the beginning of the movie loses his temper. Hanks already knows it's probably going to happen. He reminds him, it's like, we're just going to talk.
Yep.
And you see he reacts instantly without hesitation to the two guys that are there to back up. I always forget the guy's name that plays.
Oh, Finn McGovern?
Yeah.
Kieran Hines, is that his name?
Yeah. Kieran Hines. So do you want to? Is that it?
Really, that's. And then when he obviously, and the scene ends with him, you know, saying, I'm glad it's you, Michael, which is like one of the. It's one of those moments that I think it's one of the few criticisms I have of the movie, because it's a great line, but at the same time, it feels somewhat unrealistic. It's kind of like, it's that sense of calm that cool guys get to have in cool movies. It's like, when you're about to die, you don't say something like that.
Yeah, I totally get it. It's like very Hollywood, but you're like not mad at it?
No.
Yeah. A couple things I just want to pop up or read about real quick. The piano duet scene. The scene speaks volumes and shows a relationship without saying a single word, which also has the great line by Daniel Craig.
Yeah, why are you always smiling? Yeah, because
it's also fucking hysterical.
Yeah.
Just a great line. When he holds the banker at gunpoint.
Yeah.
Is the banker, which one's the banker?
You're talking about when Hanks robs him, he says, no, you keep
that. Oh, that part. Yeah. That's probably what he's talking about. So my fist pump moment is actually when he flips the piece of paper over that says,
oh yeah,
you know, kill Sullivan and all debts are paid.
Yeah.
Which is in the actual book or comic, it says all sins are forgiven.
Yeah.
Which I like that more, but I get it. Sometimes you got to like be on the nose for your audience. But that whole scene is awesome. And it starts off with like one of the first fist pumps, which is like, are you going to frisk me?
Yeah.
It's like, should I? It's
like,
probably.
Yeah.
You know?
Probably should.
I just have one. You know, and he's not lying.
Right.
That's the other thing is I it's been so long since I'd watched it, I'd forgot that Hanks actually wasn't lying when he said he just had one.
Yeah, right. He goes for the guy's gun. That's how he uses
the other guy's gun.
Yeah.
But I just love that scene. It's such a great scene. It's really intense. And those are the type of scenes we talk about that make you feel like you're watching an action movie, even though it's like a drama.
It's funny you say that, because the one thing about this movie, if I had to point to one reason why it isn't remembered.
God damn it. Are you going
to
say you don't like it?
What?
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, the only thing I was going to say, and I think you'll agree, and I know this is one of the criticisms of this movie, is that the only thing that doesn't land for some people is the idea that this nice guy, Tom Hanks, is this imposing, basically evil gangster character who's murdered a lot of people.
Yeah.
That he doesn't have the presence of that. He doesn't have that kind of presence. And I think it's fine. Like, I like it, actually. But I was going to say, the one thesis statement that I really thought about using and maybe should have used is the role of Michael Sullivan should have been played by Russell Crowe. It's pretty much a slam dunk on every level. It's where he was in his career. He has the physicality that Hanks doesn't have. He feels like he can play evil like more completely. It's just, I wonder if this movie would be an all-time movie if Russell Crowe had played Michael Sullivan. It's the one thing I think about.
I love that.
Right,
I think that's brilliant. Like, I'm really glad we're not doing recast, because you would have destroyed me. I hope I would have came
to that upon conclusion. That.
But that's great, man. That is a really good thesis, and I have nothing to say. I just completely agree.
It's like, I don't know that the movie would have been better, but it's
but how could it not have been?
Yeah,
because all the things that you would complain about with Hanks, Crowe covers.
Yeah,
he's kind of a dick.
Yeah,
you want him to be that way.
Yeah,
whereas like with Hanks, you really Hanks, the thing that's cool about it, and it's the same thing that is the reason we all love Tom Hanks, is he's the everyman.
Yeah.
That we all love, and it's the kind of the thing. It's like, you hope there's people like that in crime that just get it. He's still ruthless. He's still a killer, but he's got morals.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's like, I guess the difference is that you feel like Hanks respects and treats Paul Newman. Like, I guess you feel like the reason he is what he is because he feels like he owes a debt to someone. Not because he's evil at heart, but he has his loyalty runs so deep that's why he does what he does. And so anyway, that was just my thought. But Yeah, it's a great scene. Like,
yeah, it's an excellent scene, and I just love it. It's just really ruthless and just like, it's what I wanted.
He just takes them both out.
Yeah, done. Instant pop in the head, reads the note, and then he just jets home.
Yeah.
Again, this movie's so good.
Yeah, it really is.
Let's move on.
All right, guys, we're going to get a little bit of star profiles here, talk about where these guys were in their careers. We mentioned Hanks a little bit, the prime of his career. Beginning in 1999, Toy Story 2, following that up with Green Mile in 1999. And I said 1992.
Toy Story 2 in 99.
And finally Cast Away in 2000. And then this was the next film he did. It looks like he took a year off. He didn't do anything in 2001, but he had Catch Me If You Can and this film, both released in 2002. Yeah, this is, I mean, we talk about primes, Toy Story 2, Green Mile, Castaway. Like, Hanks was just, and then Catch Me If You Can in this movie. He was just slaying it. That's five in a row that are just like.
This is like already after he'd won back-to-back Oscars.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is great because it's going to lead into our discussion. So I want to talk about Newman now. So Newman, obviously, he was much older. He was working still kind of consistently at this point, you know? So he did. Yep. Twilight in 1998, not to be confused with the other Twilight. Message in a Bottle in 1999, and Where the Money Is in 2000. And so this brings forth the conversation, which is great because you actually just referenced the other thesis you had, and I actually have another great thesis to introduce our next segment. And the other thesis I had was that this movie stars two of the great timeless actors ever.
Yeah.
Two of the greatest. And you mentioned that in our tease, or you teased it in the beginning of the show, that we were going to talk about these timeless greats.
Yeah, I think if the discussion is who were the most timeless, ageless movie stars of all time, maybe the conversation starts with Paul Newman. You know, in my personal opinion, I'll jump in. I think we're going to each throw a few names out there. Newman, to me, is the ultimate all-time guy. And for so many reasons. For the reasons that he wasn't just a great actor, he became a national treasure in the same way that when Ronald Reagan was elected president. Like, you imagine Paul Newman maybe could have done the same thing.
That's an interesting point.
He raced cars. His car racing and his collection was legendary. He was just like a badass in general. And I mean, I had
never really been a fan of Paul Newman in the sense of like watching his films, even though my mom liked him. But I always knew that he was one of the greatest, coolest dudes ever to walk the earth. You know what I mean?
A lot of people don't realize because Paul Newman's career, a lot of his famous movies, like he won his Best Actor in 1986, and you know, The Sting is 1973, Butch Cassidy is 1969. People don't realize Paul Newman got his first Oscar nomination for Hud in 1957.
This movie came out in 2002.
Yeah, he was consistently acting since like the early 50s. Like Paul Newman had a career, like a legitimate, dramatic, slam dunk type of career as the most handsome, charismatic, charming leading man for 50 years. For 50 actual years.
Yeah.
Mind blowing.
And so this begins the discussion of who else can and has done this, because you even throw in the Brandos and the Steve McQueens of the world, and their careers just aren't as full.
No, I mean, people kind of achieve their fame at different times, but when you achieve it and you maintain longevity, it's a completely different conversation. So we're going to run through a few guys right now.
Yeah, so your first one was Newman, and it's because you've been a huge fan of Paul Newman since I met you in your whole life. So the one that I think is interesting is kind of on the other side of that is Nicholson.
Yeah.
Nicholson has been around forever. Now, I know he's really getting towards the end of his career, and you can even see it in The Departed, which is like, that's, you know,
it's 10 years ago.
So it's still 10 years ago. You're like, damn, you're getting old, man.
Yep.
But he's still fantastic, and he's still at the top of his game. A Jack Nicholson film coming out now, I think it would start to really feel that way when you watch him on screen. It's like the Gene Hackman thing that happened when you saw him on screen and you were like, damn, you got old really fast.
Yeah.
Nicholson's amazing because he was never the heartthrob, even though he was a really good-looking guy.
Yeah.
And I always like to refer to Guy Pearce as another really good-looking guy that was never the heartthrob because he's just kind of got this look about it.
He's got that I-want-to-punch-you face.
Yeah, he's kind of a prick.
Yep.
But I love Nicholson. I think he's got an incredible career, and I think he will really go down as one of the timeless greats.
And in the same way that when you talk about his career, like really going back, films like Five Easy Pieces and like he goes into the late 50s, early 60s, I believe.
And he also worked consistently his whole career.
Whole career.
Doing everything.
Yeah, he was famous for 50 years. Still is. Yeah. So I would say the next one on my list is a little younger. It's George Clooney. Clooney, I think, in a lot of ways, has the Newman effect in the sense that he's like the most charming man alive. Like he's got that part of Newman's fame down to a T.
Yeah.
He's the guy with the million-dollar smile that always he plays the smartest guy in the room, the charismatic, anything better than most anybody that's ever lived. He's about as good as it gets in our generation for that guy.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you mentioned this when we were like prepping the show, and it's not that I disagree with you.
Yeah.
I just am not fully on board. I think that if Clooney ends his career strong, he doesn't even have to like do anything crazy. If he just ends it strong,
yeah,
100% I agree. Because Clooney is just a timeless guy. He was the biggest movie star in the world when we were growing up.
Yeah, you know? I believe that George Clooney, I don't really see him totally slowing down. And I think if he has 7 or 8 more like notable movies, like really movies that stand out in their given year over the next 2 decades, and he carries that into his 70s, mm-hmm. he will be on this list as one of the 10 best ever. And I think he will. He doesn't strike me as a guy who's getting any worse as he gets older. So one thing that you notice about Clooney when you watch him is there was late 90s Clooney. There was like, you know, Out of Sight and Batman and all those type of movies.
Yes.
And then
the nipples.
There was the mid-2000s Clooney where he wins the Oscar for like Syriana, movies like that. And you started to see it in like The Descendants and Up in the Air. He's starting to age into the kind of like grizzled dad a little bit, but yeah. he's every bit as convincing. He's not the young brash guy anymore. Now he's like just that guy. You see it in his face and it's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And he really is a phenomenal actor as well. So my next one is Hanks, and I'm just going to skip over him because we've already talked about him a lot.
Yeah.
I just think he's had an incredible career. He's won back-to-back Oscars. That's only been done a handful of times, and he's continues to make movies, even though this latter part of his career has kind of been a little weaker. I mean, a lot weaker than the beginning of his career. It doesn't mean that when Tom Hanks movies come out, they're not going to be good in the same sense as now when you see a Nick Cage movie come out, it's kind of a joke.
It's bad, yeah.
When a Tom Hanks movie comes out, it can still be a Best Picture nominee.
Totally.
Always happens.
You know, like all the guys that we grew up watching thinking they were all going to age into this, it was hard for us to fathom as we were growing up that Bruce Willis and Nick Cage and Mel Gibson, and that all of these guys weren't going to just be staples. Most of them have fallen way down the totem pole.
Yeah.
And they're not the same as they were when we were growing up. And that's what happens. It's not easy to be one of these guys that has the 30 to 50 year career. So I think you said it best before we started this, which is that if Hanks died tomorrow.
Yeah, and it always sucks to bring death into this, but it is a feeling with like losing a national treasure. And I'll speak to when Hoffman and Williams died around the same time. It felt around the same time.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Hoffman's one of the greatest actors ever.
Yep.
And his death, I think, goes kind of forgotten a lot of the time by the general public.
Yeah.
Whereas like when Williams died, it was like, oh my God, we'd lost a national treasure. And I just don't think that Hoffman reached that level, because even though Williams wasn't around for 50 years, what he did, like from being Aladdin to being in Insomnia to doing Goodwill Hunting, it's just like I think Williams is one of these guys.
Yeah, Williams got there. He's like a national treasure. Like I think if you were going to try to really do the all-time top 10, I think
he's not in there.
It's hard to make the list for anything. But yeah. PSH you just mentioned, and I think the biggest reason that Philip Seymour Hoffman feels like he becomes a tragic story less than an icon is because he only really was doing work for 15 years. He had an amazing 15 years, but he really only was working from the late 90s to when he passed. So, you know, that's really only like just over 15 years.
Yeah. So what about your last guy? Like what about someone that's like still working a lot? Cause Clooney's kind of stopped working as much.
He still works. I would say the other comp, all these names of guys we talk about, it's not Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise.
My other guy's Denzel Washington.
Okay, yeah.
And Denzel, for me, is another guy where, okay, we talk about Denzel's hero career, his 2000s career, and his late 90s career, the movies that we remember. We don't talk a lot about his 80s career, his 80s and his mid-90s career.
Yeah, we just don't know it that well, or I don't know it that well.
He was nominated for Cry Freedom in 1987. He got nominated for Best Actor for Malcolm X in 92. It's one of the great travesties is that Al Pacino beat him for Son of a Woman. People talk about that to this day as one of the all-time misses the Academy had. This guy won Best Supporting Actor for Glory in 1989. Like, he's got a run from the mid-80s till now. Denzel's got over 30 years of primetime movie experience, and he just got nominated for Best Actor last year.
Look, man, you don't gotta convince me.
I love me some Denzel. I 100% agree.
If Denzel works for 10 more years, and he does 10 more years of solid movies, Equalizer 2 thrown in there, a couple more hero movies, plus like maybe, you know, maybe the aging boxing trainer movie or some other cliche like that.
But, right.
You know, a couple other big movies. No question, he's top 10.
Yeah, and there's another great thing. I mean, you just have to reference it. You got to speak about race here, and I'll be the one that does it because, you know, it just popped in my head. Michael B. Jordan, there's great interviews out there about him coming up and, like, what it was like to be a black kid growing up. It was like, who you want to be? Denzel. Yeah, of course. That's it. That's the only one. And so, like, it's what's so cool about that is not only has he influenced this next generation, but it's also inspired. It's now, you know, African-American kids growing up in America can be like, well, I don't know. There's a million of them. Not a million, but there's dozens of them. As before, it used to just be like Denzel.
Yeah.
And so I love that. And I completely agree. I think Denzel is a national treasure. And he's also a national treasure on this show. My last one is Gosling.
Oh, interesting. You go young.
I wanted to go young because I wanted to talk about someone that was on their way up.
Yeah.
You know, and someone that might be able to make it. And there's not... I love Hardy. I love Fassbender.
Yeah.
I think Gosling has the Newman effect. Yeah. And I think that he's going to... As long as he keeps doing what he's doing... And The Nice Guys was a really great thing for me because it showed you again... Look, we all know that Gosling is great at being in dramas. He's good at being in romantic comedies. He's good at being in romance movies. But that movie... It was just so great for me because he's so funny too.
Yeah.
You know, and the guy can do it all. You've seen it all. You've seen it from Half Nelson to Blue Valentine to The Nice Guys. He can do it all. So as long as he keeps and women love him. Yeah. I love him. I think he's gorgeous.
The name we left off the list who is the most likely candidate though, who's young-ish, is DiCaprio. And it's only
totally.
And the only thing about DiCaprio that is a little bit less on the radar is that he's a pretty quiet, pretty enigmatic public presence, except when it comes to politics. He speaks out on like issues that he feels are important. Aside from that, though, he's really just a very talented actor. And I do wonder what his career looks like in terms of the sort of Marlon Brando effect of like just working and working and working and keeping working. It feels hard to imagine DiCaprio not being that guy. But really the meat of his career, again, has only been 15 to 20 years at this point. He's got a lot of work to do. The Gosling thing I wonder is, as Gosling gets older, does his tonality as a character actor expand beyond what we've seen him do a lot, which is playing like the really intense quiet guy, which is like the Drive character, the kind of zany funny guy, which is like we saw him do in Nice Guys.
Yeah.
And Crazy Stupid Love is kind of like that a little bit.
Yeah, but he's also way cool in it.
Yeah. And then like there's, you know, he has like his honest sort of sad guy, which is like Half Nelson and Blue Valentine.
Yeah.
And I wonder if he's going to age into... I guess feeling like a little less of a handsome guy. Is he going to be able to age into something where I feel like he could play that
like
dad?
In the same sense where you feel like Brad Pitt kind of suffered from being too handsome early in his career?
He's like not really... I stopped being able to relate to Brad Pitt as somebody who I thought was going to get better as an actor. I don't feel like he improved in the last five
years. Yeah, you and I don't really see eye to eye, but I actually do agree. I'm leaning more towards your side now with Pitt, unfortunately.
He's a great actor. Yeah. It's just like he has this one thing he does so much, and I don't feel like I see beyond Brad Pitt very often. So,
yeah. All right, let's move on.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the guys that made this movie. Really, really small team overall. Yeah. David Self writes the screenplay, and David Self is not somebody who you're like, oh, he did these other three huge movies. He did The Haunting, 13 Days, a couple other movies that like aren't really super notable in this movie. This is basically his whole career, and the crazy part is he's the only screenwriter. It's based on a graphic novel by Max Allen Collins and Richard Piers Rayner, not guys who did work that I remembered. And the people that I know that have read this comic book have all told me they took liberties with the screenplay and improved the story by like tenfold.
Yeah.
The movie's way better than the comic.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that we really referenced in this movie that makes it feel like the movies that we love is that Jude Law was not in the original comic. And I think he was very necessary in this film.
Absolutely.
And to speak to what you were saying earlier about Hanks being imposing is that's why they made Law the way he was. You know, they made him rodent-like and pale and kind of squirmy and small so that Hanks seemed like someone that Hanks could take on.
Yeah.
And I also read that Law was, he was so disgusted by the way he looked. He was always wearing a cap when he wasn't filming. He hated it.
Do you think, I read that too, and it made me think like, honestly, the thing I thought was like, come on, man.
Right?
Like, that's
me
what
too.
I was like,
what do you mean?
Yeah, what I thought was just like, stop being such a pretty boy.
Yeah,
like,
get over yourself, like, dude. This is huge for pretty boys.
Yeah.
This is the kind of role pretty boys die for.
What, because you're like
for.
Balding? Like, it's a character in a movie. What are you talking about?
Yeah, dude, you're like an awesome villain by the end. You're like creepy and pale and balding. You got scars on your face. Like,
yeah.
awesome.
Totally. I was like, you're kind of a bitch, man. What are you talking about? But I mean, whatever. He's a great fucking actor. He's done incredible work that I love. So that is what it is. But he also did end up getting into kind of a little bit of a character role as his career went on, of playing these like very weak characters. He's incredibly weak in Closer.
Which is so funny because he is like such a like a charismatic presence when he wants to be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, Closer's a great movie, by the way.
It's a very good movie.
Directed by Sam Mendes. This is the follow-up to Sam Mendes' debut film, American Beauty, which Mendes has a very peculiar career. So let's just cover this production team, which he's a part of, quickly before we talk about his specific film career. Mendes is one of three producers on this movie. Again, in a surprising turn while researching this, Mendes doesn't produce all his own movies. Like, when you read that, like, oh, he produced his second movie, he must produce all his movies.
Right.
He produced this and Revolutionary Road, and that's it.
Again, like, the guy's career makes no damn sense to me.
It's weird. And then the producers on the film, Dean Zanuck and Richard D. Zanuck, the late Richard D. Zanuck, legendary, legendary producer behind uncredited EP on Sound of Music, Jaws, The Verdict, Sugarland Express, Driving Miss Daisy, tons of movies, a bunch of Best Picture winners in there, blockbusters, like, just big time stuff. So, you know, Richard D. Zanuck, and so Dean Zanuck was his son. This was Zanuck's second film. Dean's, his first being Reign of Fire.
great McConaughey film.
Yep. And Dean, that'd be a fun one for us to cover sometime.
Yeah, who plays the villain in Reign of Fire? Do you know? I'm pretty sure I know off the top of my head.
Is it 300? No,
Xerxes?
No, isn't it I'm fucking thirsty.
I'm fucking thirsty.
Isn't Gerard? Butler?
I actually don't know. I was thinking it might be someone else, but you could be right. I just want to know.
Gerard Butler or it's
Christian
Oscar
Bale.
Isaac.
And Gerard Butler's in it.
Bale's not the villain, though, is he?
No, I think he's the good guy. Fucking, or one of the good guys. Christian Bale, Matthew McConaughey, and Gerard Butler are in Reign of Fire.
Yeah. I think Butler's the villain.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Good pull.
That's a good pull, buddy.
That'd be a sweet one to come.
That's pretty funny.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
I want to talk about Sam Mendes.
Yeah,
I want to talk about his career because it doesn't make any damn sense at all. So he's got American Beauty. Who doesn't know American Beauty?
Yeah,
you know, one Best Picture. He won. He wins.
Best Director.
Best Director. And then he goes and he does this right afterwards, which again, we don't really know what's wrong with this film,
no,
the anomaly behind it, but it's fantastic. And then he goes on to do movies like Revolutionary Road and Spectre and Skyfall. And
Jarhead.
I'm missing, Jarhead
and
in 2000.
Away We Go, which is his indie comedy.
And like, I don't love Jarhead, but it's not bad. A lot of people really like that movie. This movie's fantastic.
There's
Beauty is still excellent to this day.
One of my favorites. There's a perception thing that happens. This happens to people. So
the villain is McConaughey.
Really?
Butler is not the villain. The dragon is the villain.
That's been a long time.
I've never seen it.
Yeah. When you, I did remember watching that movie. When you come out and your debut film is American Beauty, and you're 33 years old when you make it, and it wins Best Picture, and it's this definitive movie that year. It wasn't one of those years where people were like, oh, what's going to win in 1999? Is it going to be, you know, Boys Don't Cry or Girl Interrupted? It was like, no, American Beauty was just going to win the whole time. That's always what was going to happen. And that movie wins Best Picture, and everybody's like, Kevin Spacey is just amazing, and this movie was so beautiful, and the music was incredible, and cinematography was unbelievable. I think there was an expectation, and it's what happens to people. And I think the expectation was so high for Road to Perdition because of everything we talked about that I don't think people disliked it. I just think it was like they would have had to do something else.
Yeah, I mean,
to stand
I get
out
it.
For
you
people.
You definitely love it a little more than I do, and part of that could just be the whole father-son aspect
as well.
Because like I know that's a bit, it speaks to you strongly, and I can't really relate to it as well. But even so, this movie is still a very, very, very good film by all standards.
So Jarhead's the next movie in 2005, and Jarhead, I think, is the one where you start to talk about perception. There was an idea behind Jarhead that it was going to be this, like, one half of the people that saw it coming out was like Sam Mendes, this will be an interesting war movie, like a psychological thing. And then one half people were like, oh, war movie, sweet, 2005, this is great.
Yeah,
the Iraq war is going on.
Exactly.
And people saw that movie for weird reasons. There was really no action. It's Jamie Foxx and Jake Gyllenhaal, right?
I know it's Gyllenhaal. I think you're right with Fox.
And Fox had just won Best Actor. So again, it was like, it's a big movie that year. And
a big director.
Yeah. And I think that movie, that's the one to me that I when I look back on, I'm like, that's just so weird that that's Sam Mendes.
And then 2005 is Revolutionary Road.
05 is Jarhead. 08 is
Star Wars. I mean, 08 is Revolutionary Road. And then, which is interesting because that movie was really highly regarded, but it was only because of the acting.
Because of Winslet and
Leo.
Yeah, and it was their return to screen together.
Yeah, and like it was interesting that when I went and did the first of all, he's directed what, 8 films? 9? 8.
Those 4. 8 with 9 in the work.
He's got a 9th one in the works.
And the 2 Bond movies.
Yeah. And so like when I went and saw that, and Sam Mendes is one of those names you hear, like, I know that name. Right. And you go back and you look, you're like, wait, this is American Beauty, this is, you know, Road to Perdition, this is Skyfall. And it in Revolutionary Road is also another really big one that stands out to me, that it's just like, this is another huge movie. I remember working at Blockbuster. I remember the Academy Awards that year. It was a huge movie, and he got no credit.
Yeah, it was one of those movies that the hype was out of control because of Mendes and because of those two actors, and it missed a little bit for some people. It was a really slow movie. I saw this in theaters.
And you know the general audience believes that Skyfall, or not the general audience, let me say, everyone that doesn't think that, what's the first movie? Casino Royale is the best in the Craig franchise.
They think Skyfall
is the next best.
Yeah.
Now, he also directed Spectre, which we'll just let that go because it hadn't happened yet. But even then, Skyfall is still good. And I know Bond is a massive franchise, but it's not the same as it used to be.
No. No, no. And Skyfall, I would agree. Skyfall's number 2 in that run.
Yeah, definitely.
Behind Casino, because 2 and 4 are not good movies. I don't even particularly like Skyfall, but I don't think it's bad.
I just like Javier.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about ranking these movies. I'll go first and say I have never seen Away We Go. I've never seen that's his indie comedy.
Yeah, I think, how about we just do like top 3 then, or 5 or something?
Well, let's just
do them all.
We've both seen them all.
There's 8 of them.
Except for that one.
Okay.
None of us have seen that movie, right?
Yeah, so Away We Go.
So we'll strike that from the record because it's the only movie that's like not a big movie.
Yeah.
I think we can both agree that American Beauty is 1.
Absolutely, American Beauty is 1. I think we both agree that this is 2.
Perdition is 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. After that, I think it gets a little harder, and I would almost lean towards... I guess Skyfall?
Yeah, I think you got to go Skyfall. I mean, I guess this is kind of... I guess us literally going through this exercise right now is kind of explaining why.
Yeah, I mean, it's not because I don't...
If your second best movie you've ever made is Road to Perdition and your best movie is American Beauty, there's still a big gap there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't love Skyfall. People love Skyfall. But exactly. Skyfall is an intelligent and unique Bond movie. And I think the people that don't like Skyfall for the most part feel like it's a melodramatic Bond movie that doesn't feel like what you want out of Bond.
Right, and I think then if you do know Skyfall very well and you're also a big fan of Revolutionary Road, I think Revolutionary Road is probably actually the better film on paper. So I think you go Revolutionary Road next, right?
Yep, I would go 4 because it's slow, and that's the reason Revolutionary Road is not a good movie in my mind. It's just like a really like, it's just a slow fucking movie. It's like a relationship that's failing, and like, I think that there's some suicide or something.
Yeah, it's just intense. It's just like dark and intense and slow. And so what it really comes down to is what's better, Jarhead or Spectre?
Oh, Jarhead by a mile.
Right, absolutely. Spectre's that's what I have. Spectre was
awful.
It was an abomination of film for us. And I hope we go back and watch it one day, and it's much better. But we've told the story many times on the show, and we told it on the Casino Royale episode with our friend Kathy Kelly. We were doing Spectre that week. We went and saw it together, or I went and saw it, and it was... We both had saw it separately.
No, with Haggerty. We all saw it together.
Oh, yeah, me, you, and Haggerty. And it was just like, what the fuck is going on?
It was almost like somebody said, hey, there wasn't enough action in Skyfall, so you're going to need to start it out with a big, cool action sequence, which they did.
It was cool-ish.
It was the best part of the movie, and then the rest of that movie absolutely was terrible. So, anyway, I think that's pretty dumb.
It's not that we didn't like Skyfall. We do think it's the second best in the Craig franchise, and I like it more than you do.
Yep.
It's just that it's not as good. It's not even close to Casino Royale, in my opinion.
Casino's awesome. Yeah. But, you know, Skyfall is a polarizing one. So I think the ranking for us there of Sam Mendes films are American Beauty, Road to Perdition, Skyfall, Revolutionary Road, Jarhead, and Spectre, with Away We Go as the footnote that neither of us have seen, so unfair to rank it, though I've heard it's quite good. So
Yeah, I actually have as well.
Let's continue moving down the list here, guys. Let's get into critical and box office.
Yeah, so this is pretty interesting. It was produced by DreamWorks. It cost $80 million to make. I'm sure a lot of that went to star power, as the sets were not crazy. Wardrobe was really tough. I remember reading about it was really hard for them to find the clothes for this because you couldn't look cool during the Prohibition.
Right.
Everyone was poor. So they found a designer in town anyway. $80 million to make. It was released in July of 2002. It grossed $104 million and an additional $76 worldwide for a grand total of $181 million. Now, this is super interesting to me. It opened number two. What did I say?
Behind
something?
Men in Black 2. That's what
yeah, behind Men in Black 2, but it was only by $2 million.
Yeah.
Men in Black 2 made $24 million its opening weekend, and this made $22, which is crazy to me, because Men in Black, as you and I both know, the good guys dress in black, remember that?
Just in case you ever face-to-face and make contact.
Yeah, there was actually a cool reference to Men in Black on the last Schmodown match. Now, it was massive.
Yeah, huge.
Huge. Will Smith was like the biggest thing in the world. Tommy Lee Jones was in his prime, and everyone loved Men in Black. So, again, this movie was only $2 million behind Men in Black 2 when it came out, and still, it was just forgotten. I just don't get it. So, critical 7.7 on IMDb, which you think is low.
Yeah, this. I mean, this, to me, this is a movie that feels like just Newman's performance alone should bring it up more to like an 8. Like,
yeah.
Like an 8.1.
And if you look at the Rotten Tomatoes score, all critics gave it an 81. Top gives it a 76, and the audience gives it an 86, which totally follows the formula for our show. And it also, for me, I do feel like 7.7. I just feel like it should have an 8. Like, it doesn't even have to be in the top 250, but just like a flat 8 seems much more respectable or legitimate. Yeah,
definitely.
So I think that moves us on to our favorite line.
Which I think we both have the same favorite line. We're just going to cue the scene up here. Steve, if you don't mind cueing that sucker up. This is just my favorite scene in the movie, and it just has everything about it. It's just great.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I also do really like the Stanley Tucci, "Those same people are protecting you now." I love that scene, too.
Yeah, Tucci's great.
Yeah, he's just a great actor. Did you watch the Capone deleted scene?
No, I heard it was a good one. Was it not?
It's worth cutting.
I read about it.
Yeah, it's worth cutting. Totally takes like the legendary value out of him.
I didn't think I'd see you again.
Read this. Connor's been stealing from you for years. He's kept accounts open under the names of dead men. Men like the McGoverns. I stood there and helped him kill Finn to line his own pockets. I thought it was working for you. But I wasn't.
You think I'd give up my son?
He was betraying you.
I know.
Such good delivery.
I tried to avoid more bloodshed. You wouldn't accept that, so I did what was necessary. But I've always loved you, like a son. And now I'm telling you, leave.
He's got a good accent.
Before it's too late.
Kills it.
Think.
He was still trying. He hired a voice coach, you know?
And they're protecting him now. But when you're gone, they're not going to need him anymore. This ends with Connor dead, no matter what.
That may be. But you are asking me to give you the key to his room so you can walk in, put a gun to his head, and pull the trigger. And I can't do that.
He murdered Annie and Peter.
There are only murderers in this room. Michael, open your eyes.
Unbelievable line.
This is the life we chose, the life we lead.
Incredible.
And there is only one guarantee. None of us will see heaven.
That's perfect. You can cut it there, honestly.
Yeah. Are only murders in this room is my favorite line in the movie.
Yeah, it's mine as well, and so is, I didn't want to cut you off, but you were going
to
say it.
Yeah, there's no guarantee that none of us are going to go to heaven. Absolutely. And when I watched this movie again, probably 8 weeks ago, I tweeted about this as one of the great underrated films. That scene was the one where I was just like, God, how, like,
right?
What? This movie's so good.
But there's all of them. The Tucci scene, the scene in the rain, the scene with the guy that is supposed to kill him, this scene, the scene with him and his son at the end with Law, like, it's fantastic. So that moves us into one other thing, or a couple other things, but I want to get to our AMA question. This is brought to us by Max Alexander.
Yeah, AMA question, just if you guys are wondering, is you guys, tweet questions at us or you leave them in the Facebook group, hashtag AMA question, and they will often show up on the show. We'll answer those questions. So today, as you mentioned, we have one from Facebook.
Yeah, it's Max Alexander on Facebook, and he says, what do we think of Mendez using water to signify death? Too heavy-handed as to be a distraction or an artistic achievement?
So I'm assuming he's referring to the scene outside in the rain?
No. Every time anyone dies in this film, there's water involved. If you look at when the guy gets capped in the thing, I think everyone's sweating. I think his wife and son are taking a bath. It's raining outside when the guy gets capped in the beginning, and Michael's covered. He's soaked, wet.
Michael's by the water.
He's by the ocean at the end. Exactly. It's every single death is all water. And I want to speak to it because, first of all, it's a great question. Thank you, Max.
Yeah.
And thanks to all you guys for all your questions. We cannot cover all of them. But in American Beauty, the red was a beautiful part of symbolism. And it's one of those things that it was used the first time and it was masterful and it was brilliant and it was groundbreaking and revolutionary. Do you wonder if using the water so much in the second one is maybe part of why Mendes' legacy died?
No, because honestly, you had to explain it to me just now, and I just watched this movie for the second time in 8 weeks, for the third time in my life, and really it didn't like feel like it was a thing. Like, if I had really thought about that, maybe it would have resonated, but it didn't distract me. I didn't feel like there was any moment that like they replaced the death scene with just like water or something.
Yeah, fair.
What do you think?
You know what? No. I really appreciate your question, and I love that as a movie viewer that you brought that up, and I like that you brought it to my attention as well, but it doesn't feel super heavy-handed. If you go in thinking about it, you'll be like, oh yeah, it happens a lot. Even when Connor gets shot, he's in a bathtub. But I actually think it's cool. I really like it. It's not too much for me.
It's subtle for me.
Yeah. Great question though, and I hope with the other questions, there's a lot of them floating around about over, under, proper, under siege, over siege, and properly siege. Thanks again for that.
That's excellent. Very smart.
About Sam Mendes, and I hope that we kind of covered that on the episode.
Absolutely. So it's funny. I'm going to skip over it really quickly here, but Cage versus Cruise is a segment we used to do a lot of, which is who would embody the lead role better, Tom Cruise or Nick Cage. And honestly, I think that in O2...
There are only murders in this room.
O2, Nick Cage was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Adaptation. He totally could have knocked this role out of the park, honestly, at that point in his career.
From you. Cruise. There are only murderers in this room.
Michael. There's only one guarantee. None of us are going to heaven.
I can't do that. All right, so the next thing is, which of the three categories does this movie fall into? Totally ridiculous, which are movies like Face Off, They Fell Off the Cliff of Absurdity, Demolition Man, which I love.
Totally legitimate. That's going to be movies like Lone Survivor, The Fugitive, and movies that are ridiculously legitimate. The middle category, Predator, Speed, Point Break. They're driven by one really credible thing, but you know, they're a little silly. And for me, I think with the expanse into these other categories in this show, it's less common that we have a discrepancy anymore. So for me, this movie's clearly totally legitimate. It's a totally legitimate movie. Action movies are more ambiguous. Really good dramas like this, they're usually just legit. Like, we're not going to do it unless it's legit.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is totally legit. Hopefully you guys agree with us. So
there's just one last thing on the show here to do, and that's going to be called
The Pitch.
What's up, guys? And guys, so this is how we're going to do this week. As you know, you can follow us on Twitter at AMA Podcast. You can go find the Facebook group, Action Movie Dummy fan page. You should do that. And of course, us personally at Ben Bateman Media and Andrew Guy. So for next week's show, for The Pitch, we're going to put it in your hands, but we're going to put up a few options inspired by our upcoming match against Team Trek, which I think we believe is airing on Tuesday.
I believe it's Tuesday next week. So by the time Wednesday rolls around, when AMA airs next week, we will either be in very good spirits or in very poor spirits.
Yes. And if we're incorrect and that doesn't air until the end of the week, so be it. Either way, next week is the week that we take on Team Trek, and the movie we cover on the show next week is going to be decided by you, fans of the show. So we'll put up a poll of three or four movies that relate to that match in some way, whether they're sci-fi, Star Trek related, fighting related. It's going to be awesome. So go ahead and follow on those platforms so you guys can vote. That's the way to do it. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening, guys. As always, we'll see you same time, same place next week.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only, and not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.